Okay, here's what's happening today. We're getting this last 2 weeks of our deep dive into the Bible. So if that's the class that you're here for with Lance, you can head on into the pack. Out here, I'm done with the Old Testament survey, but today I'm going to be doing a presentation on my thesis, which is about the grief of a child. And so if you're interested in that, then you can stay here. So you get to pick whether you want to go into a deep dive on the doctrinal statement on the Bible, or out here, and we're going to be talking about children that are grieving death. So those are your options. You can head on into the pack or stay here, and we'll get started in just a second. If you just came in, you didn't hear, every family is getting one of these, so feel free to grab one of those before they're all gone. It's like super quiet. Like, I'm still in like turkey coma mode, or everyone's all like... The fog, the morning fog, has everybody all subdued. Don't worry, I'll keep you awake with a lively thesis discussion. Nothing says keep me awake like a thesis. All right, looks like people headed out wanted to head out. It means you're all here. So we're gonna go ahead and get started. Josh, would you mind grabbing that door for us? Because you know, Lance, once he starts yelling, it's going to be impossible for us to focus. So, all right. Welcome to today. I want to have a presentation today that I hope will be helpful to you when it comes to the grief of a child. This is the title of my thesis: "The Grief of a Child: Counseling the Dynamic Heart of an Elementary Age Child Who is Grieving Death." And part of the reason for doing this, some of you asked, like, hey, can we hear more about this? You've spent spent time and energy doing this. We'd love to hear more about it. Also because it's a topic that is interesting, I think, to parents and to anybody that tries to give any type of care to children. So what I want to do today is first walk through the why, and I even have an outline for you, that way you don't get lost in all the details. So today I want to walk through the why of my thesis. What is it? How do I develop what's in my thesis? What are some key takeaways? And then what are some useful resources? So that's where we're going today in this discussion. So I want to start out with the why. Even before I talk about the why of this particular thesis, why a doctorate in biblical counseling? Like, why did it even go that direction? And really, the simple answer is for the education. So I didn't do this in order to be able to say I'm a doctor. In fact, some of you have asked, are we going to start calling you doctor now? And the answer would be no. Like, I'm not asking for that. And I mean, Joe's already done just to make fun of me. But doctor is not even in my top three favorite and important titles, right? It doesn't even make the top three. So husband is more important to me. Dad is more important to me. Pastor is more important to me. Those three titles mean way more than doctor does. So I'm not like changing my email signature from pastor to doctor. That's not what's going to happen. I was concerned about pursuing this because I wanted more education, and I wanted to do something that touched a breadth of ministry. So there's a variety of different doctorates that you can pursue. There's some seminaries, and they only provide a doctorate, for instance, in preaching. And I wanted something that would be broader than that. I wanted it more than just, I want to know more about preaching. The thing about biblical counseling is it ends up touching things like my preaching, but it also touches private ministry of the word, touches how we understand people, it touches how I counsel myself. I wanted something that had a breadth to it, and so that's why I pursued this. So it's been a 6-year process. Some of you knew about it, some of you didn't. So 4 of those years I've spent here with you. I started this 2 years before I came here. And when I started pursuing this degree, we did not have Luca. COVID had not happened, and I had not come here to church plant. So this was not, there were a few things that changed in our lives that we weren't really planning on when I started this. But the intent was a breadth of education and application for my pastoral ministry. And the way I ended up at this particular thesis topic really was a combination of things that I was experiencing and then a profound sense that I was ill-equipped and unequipped to help people. So at Grace Church of the Valley, we had multiple families that had significant tragedies while we were a part of that church family. There was a family whose baby accidentally drowned and was the youngest of three kids. There was an oldest son of five who died of an accidental shooting. There was a child who was adopted that died during a relatively routine surgery and was the youngest of four. And each time we'd go through these kinds of significant tragedies and parents would come to me, I was functioning in part as children's pastor, as well as other things that I was doing, and parents would come and they'd want help for themselves, but particularly they wanted help for their other grieving children. Like, how can we help our children? What kind of book should I have them read? How can I help them? And every single time I felt inadequate and unequipped, and I also struggled to find resources to point them to. From a biblical counseling standpoint, I felt like there wasn't a ton to offer them. And I felt that lack like deeply in my soul. And so that's partly what led me to this particular thesis idea. I felt like there was a lack of a go-to comprehensive biblical guide to children and grief. And so in chapter one of my thesis, probably what happens in chapter one is I survey the literature that's out there and really concluded that there are resources for adults on a whole variety of biblical counseling areas, but there's not a similar wealth of information for children. So as a whole, the biblical counseling movement has underdeveloped resources for children. There are secular resources out there, and yet inevitably, as we think about a secular resource with children and grieving death, it always introduced a struggle between a biblical worldview and a secular one, and what part of this should I accept as a Christian, what part should I be concerned about, and all in all, felt like there was a surprising lack of resources on grief in general, including even grief for adults. So that's why I landed on this particular thing. Really a combination of experience, what I was doing in children's ministry, and then the kind of counseling that I was doing. So I want to talk just for a second about a thesis and what it is and how it works. So a thesis is an academic, it's a very formal presentation. So what I talk through, I'm gonna read from some of my thesis, and you'll see pretty quickly, like, oh, this is like academic. So some of you have said you're interested in my thesis, which I'm happy for you to even start to read it if you want to start reading it. But this is not like fun reading or like, oh, it's not in like popular book format. A thesis is an academic paper. So you'll see in just a second. So something that is academic, it's formal, it's trying to make an argument. It's also very, very narrow. So for a thesis to be accepted within the academic world, several things have to happen. One, you have to talk about something that is underdeveloped. So it has to be an area that there's not a lot of other information on, because otherwise, why would you write a thesis on something that there's already tons of information on? But at the same time, it has to have a research element, which was a funny struggle. I'm supposed to be researching something that there's not a ton of information on. So how do you juggle that? So it's research, but also something that is needed. And you have to write it in a way that it has to fit all the rules. You have to follow all the rules when you write a thesis, right? So some of the things that are in my thesis are because I'm required to write a certain way. You're not really supposed to use I a lot, so you end up writing really strange things like, this author believes, and it just sounds like pretentious and stupid, but that's because that's how it works in the academic world. All right, here's the what of my thesis. The idea of a thesis is this central idea. It runs throughout. It's five chapters long, runs throughout. So here is the actual thesis statement. Here's my argument. Grieving children need loving caregivers to help them understand and process the effects of grief on their dynamic thoughts, feelings, and actions. Elementary-aged children grieve differently than adults because of their developing hearts, which have lesser capabilities to process that grief, and they need theologically sound and developmentally sensitive counseling from adults that they trust. So that's a mouthful. You can even see how narrow it is. I narrow down to elementary age children. So it's not just children, it's elementary age children. The point is it needs to be pretty specific. All right, this author, I know, you're like, bleh, but all right. This author's thesis is that effective communication to grieving children flows from a clear theology of grief and death, an understanding of the nature of a grieving child's mind, emotions, and behavior, and wise practical application of creative communication strategy. So this is kind of the guts of the whole thing, right? If we're gonna have effective communication to grieving children, we have to start with a clear theology of death and grief. We have to understand from a biblical standpoint, what is death and what is grief? And then we also have to understand the nature of a grieving child's mind, emotions, and behavior. So how does a child's mind work? How do their emotions work? What's driving their behavior? We have to understand development. And then we have to pursue these wise, practical application. We have to do something with this information, and we have to communicate creatively. There have to be creative communication strategies when it comes to a grieving child. So a couple things that are kind of terms throughout my thesis that are important. I use the term caregivers, and that's an attempt to, it's not a precise category. I'm trying to say broadly a caregiver can include a parent, can be a Sunday school teacher, can be a children's pastor. So the idea of caregiver, like why didn't I just say parent? Well, because I wanted to try to hit a variety of different people that could be giving care to a child that is grieving. So caregiver is not a precise category. It's a broad one. Elementary aged, for my purposes, is basically first through sixth grade. So we're talking kind of in your 6 to 11 to 12 year old kind of age, and then the idea of development is this important concept that there are realities of a growing child who's in the process of maturing, but they're not fully formed in their personal growth. So children have great potential, but they have limited or lesser capabilities than a mature adult. So those limitations include things like mental capacities. So children have a lack of information, for instance. As we mature, we get more information about life, and children don't have that because they're children. They have a difficulty in grasping certain concepts. So especially younger children struggle to grasp abstract concepts. So they think very concretely, they don't think very well in the abstract. And that's just an issue of development. And so how do we help a grieving child who thinks in very concrete terms? So that when you tell this child who thinks in very concrete terms, you know, grandpa is sleeping now, and you're using that to refer to death, the 6.5-year-old goes, sleeping? Oh, I do that every night. What, grandpa's sleeping? Should I be afraid to go to sleep at night? Because you said grandpa's sleeping, but now we have all this sadness about grandpa, and all of a sudden your 6.5-year-old is like freaked out about sleeping. You can't figure out why. And it's because, you know, some Sunday school teacher said, oh, they're asleep with Jesus now, and the kid goes concretely, oh yeah, I know what sleep is, boom, right? They're not thinking in abstract terms, right? It's a development thing. Right. So there is mental capacities that are in the process of developing. There are emotional capacities. For instance, children sometimes may not even be able to define what emotion they're experiencing. They don't even have words for this is what I'm feeling. So think about how hard that is for a grieving child. Maybe they can't even put words to what it is that they're experiencing. They can't even tell you it feels like such and such because they're still developing in even how they understand their emotions. And not only do they maybe struggle to define those emotions, but they might also struggle to direct those feelings. How does a child manage emotions that they're just starting to figure out? And so maybe they don't know how to start feeling a certain way or stop feeling a certain way. It's a developmental issue. Children struggle with volitional capacities. So for instance, kids, and I know this is shocking to everybody in this room, this is high level thesis work right here, right? Wait for this, everybody. Kids don't always make logical choices. I know you're all blown away. This is amazing work I've done, but why do kids not always make a logical choice? Why do kids do something sometimes and you scratch your head and you go, why did you do that? Right? And that's always a funny question to me that like parents ask, because there's times that parents ask that and like inside, you know, they're not going to be able to tell me why they did that. Why can Junior or Sally not say why they did something? It's because they don't have the maturity to understand their volitional choices. They didn't make a logical choice or an appropriate choice. And you go, ha, right? Why did you do that? It's because they're a kid and they're developing. And just like their thinking is developing and their emotions are developing, their choices are in the process of developing. And they didn't put 2 + 2 together to get 4, right? They thought it was a great idea to whatever thing that you thought was wildly foolish that they did, right? So Not only that, but children, as they're maturing, they lack some life experience. So they're developing in their life experiences. For instance, you have children that may have very little exposure to death at all. So now they're experiencing this grief over death when they have had very little opportunity to ever have this sensation before. They haven't had this experience, right? That as an adult, you may become way more familiar with a funeral, for instance, or a funeral home. And you have kids that like, man, this is some of the first times I've ever been in a funeral home. I've never been to a graveyard. Like these things that are brand new experiences because they lack life experiences. All right. The reality is that the Bible does not map out specific stages of childhood development. So our Bible doesn't come and say, here are specific stages of childhood development. What the Bible does is presuppose the development process, right? So we have places like 1 Corinthians 13:11, where Paul says, when I was a child, I thought as a child, I spoke as a child, but now I've put away childish things now that I'm a man. You've got Luke 2:52 that says in reference to Jesus that he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man, all right? So that's not a clearly defined development declaration, but it's just saying kids develop, right? So thankfully, we have people who have done a lot of work in childhood development that then create kind of categories and stages, and you've got things like early childhood and middle childhood, and you've got pre-adolescence, and we have these things that we've tried to observe, but the Bible just presupposes that there is this development process that's happening. So we're talking about how do we help a child who's in the middle of this development process. Okay, so that's the kind of the guts of this thesis. Let me see what's next here. All right. So how do we go about this? And basically what I want to do is just walk through kind of what the chapters look like in this thesis. When I say the how do we try to build this thesis, this argument about children? What's the methodology? What I start with in chapter 2 is building a theology of grief and death. And so go through a bunch of different biblical passages, both Old Testament and New Testament, that talk about grief and that talk about death. And I used almost 100% of the time, I used narrative or I used story. And so why did I do that? Well, number one, the vast amount of our Bibles is in narrative or is in story form. But secondly, when we talk about an experience like grief, it really helps, because grief is such a personal and human experience, it really helps to see the biblically recorded stories of real people who went through real grief. It's similar to like watching a case study or an object lesson in a counseling book or something. We have all these stories of grief and death in our Bibles that we get to observe, and we make observations about how other people experience grief, and we can come to some conclusions. And kind of a final reason it went with so much narrative is the reality that children learn well from stories. And my hope is that even by referencing a bunch of these different stories, that caregivers can even have tools to say like, oh, hey, that's a story that I can use talking with so-and-so as we talk about, you know, David's grief with Absalom or any of these numbers of other stories that I used. So walk through a description of grief in the narratives in our Bibles. So when I talk about that, there's kind of the overarching story of redemption presents a lot of grief. So think about the whole story of redemption in your whole Bible. But think about elements of grief that show up in the story of redemption. So think about, you go all the way back to Genesis, and think about Genesis 1 and 2, where everything is perfect. There's nothing wrong in the whole entire world. Think about the introduction of grief with sin. Like, think about the profound sense of loss that Adam and Eve experience when they go from a perfect state where they have perfect relationships with God and God with them and nothing is wrong, and they go from that to the curse of sin, where they're kicked out of the garden, where their bodies begin dying, where Cain kills Abel. You have all this introduction of grief within the story of redemption itself. And then you have all this grief that goes all throughout the Old Testament. Think about how grief in the story of redemption, think about how central grief is to even the story of the gospel of Jesus dying on a cross and rising from the dead. Think of the grief that's wrapped up in the actual death of Jesus. Think about the overcoming of that grief in the resurrection of Jesus. Think about how the story of redemption, which started in a garden with everything perfect, is completed in Revelation, where we go back to Jesus returning and setting all things right. And what is one of the things that we look forward to in Revelation that Jesus says, here's what I'm going to do when I come back? He says he's going to return, and what is he going to do to tears? He's gonna wipe them all away. There's not gonna be crying or mourning or death anymore, right? What Jesus does is actually undoes all of the grief that we experience all throughout our lives, right? So the concept of grief is actually all throughout the bigger story of redemption. But then there's all these individual stories in both our Old and New Testaments that really show us grief. We see Elijah in the widow. And when we get to the New Testament, we have stories like Lazarus, and we see grief around Lazarus's death. So we have these stories of grief in our Bibles that I think are instructive. And all of that led me to come at what I hope to be a biblically constructed definition of grief. Because if I asked you, what is grief? My guess is that you would describe a lot of things about it. Like, grief is one of the things that we can talk about it, we can talk around it, but can we actually define, but what is grief particularly? And it's so hard to pin down and nail down a precise definition that a lot of people haven't tried, which maybe should have been a warning to me that I should not have tried either, all right? But grief is one of those things that, like, what words would you put to grief? So this is, after surveying all of these Old Testament, New Testament stories, here is my functioning definition of grief. So this is chapter 2, Theology of Grief and Death. So here's what I came up with. Grief is the intense response of a person's entire body and heart to a profound sense of loss, most often temporary, but sometimes overwhelming. So maybe that's a mouthful, but kind of the key components of it. Grief is the intense response. So when I talk about grief, I'm not talking about something that is easily set aside or something that is simple. Grief is intense. It's an intense, but it's also a response, right? So grief is not something that we initiate. Grief is something that we respond with. And so because of that, sometimes people feel that grief is uncontrollable because it is a response, right? I don't think that's true, but this is a response, and it's an intense one, and in two ways, a person's entire body and their entire heart. So all throughout the biblical narratives, what you would know to be true from your own life experience, we have this entire physical response. So what do we see in the biblical stories of grief? We see people doing things like weeping and wailing. We see people falling on the ground in sadness. We see people tearing their clothes, pulling out hair. You have this very physical response, right? It's this intense response of the entire body. You also have the response of the entire heart. So people think things and feel things and choose things. And all of this is this response to a profound sense of loss. I just think this idea of I've lost something is at kind of the core, at the heart of what grief is. And most of the time, when we see in the biblical accounts, most of the time it's temporary. In other words, grief is not something that stays at this level of intensity. So I'm not suggesting that grief ever completely goes away, but the kind of intense response, most often that is a temporary reality, right? That sense of shock, bewilderment, a lot of times there's something that is temporary to that. But grief is at times overwhelming. In other words, it overwhelms any other kind of rational thought, behavior. It just overwhelms somebody's life, and we see that in some of these biblical narratives, okay? So that's my functioning definition of what grief is. So that's basically what chapter 2 does, develop a theology of grief and of death. Chapter 3 deals with the dynamic heart of a child. This is taken from, actually, my supervisor, my main teacher, Jeremy Pierre. He wrote a book called The Dynamic Heart in Daily Life, Connecting Christ to Human Experience. It is not an exaggeration to say that this book is the framework and foundation for all of the counseling that I do, and even for a lot of things that you hear me say in preaching terms. By the time I got to Southern, I had already had other counseling training. For me, this book like pulled a lot of other things that I had been taught and told, and this book like brought it all together for me. So I'm so thankful that that Dr. Pierre agreed to be my supervisor and I got to work with him, because this book is crucial to how I understand the human heart and the function of the human heart. So he calls it the dynamic heart. You can see that my allusion to that. So chapter 3 is essentially taking his book and saying, how do we connect this to children? What's the connection? If we understand understand the human heart this way, how do we connect this to children? So really my thesis frames itself around his work. When I say the dynamic heart of a child, we're just talking about something that you have probably seen from me or heard from me. And this is really, this is my graphic, but it's Pierre's concept. So the idea of the dynamic heart is, and maybe some of you have heard me say this before, this is how I understand all of human experience, both my own and yours. So people come to talk with me, either I show people this, or I'm referencing it even if you don't realize it. This is what I think is the biblical picture of human experience. All right, so what we have here is a body and a heart. So both components matter. When we talk about trying to help people change, we try to talk about the human experience, we have to recognize that we are physical bodies, we are embodied people, so we can't ignore the effect of things like sleep and drug use and all these other physical things that happen to our bodies. We're physical beings that we are both body, but we're also heart. So whether you want to say inner person, outer person, part that is passing away, part that is eternal, soul is a word that some people use for heart. I think all of that is the same language, soul and body. So within our hearts, we think things, we feel things, and we choose things. So that's what the heart is. The heart is where we think and feel and choose. And all of this, you know, can back up with biblical passages on that thoughts come from our hearts, that feelings come from our hearts, and that choices come from our hearts. What I appreciated from Pierre was this idea, though, that each one of these are reinforcing the other. So this whole like double-headed arrow, your thoughts are connected to your feelings and your choices, and they're constantly enforcing or reinforcing, right? So what you think is true is going to have an impact on what you feel. And that's going to lead you to choices. And those choices you make are going to cause you to think things that are going to make future choices. If you make a choice and you think that went great, you're probably going to make that choice again. If you make a choice and you feel like, ooh, that was a bummer, I didn't like the way that choice felt, then you're going to start thinking about that choice a certain way. You're going to make a different choice the next time, right? That's the idea of dynamic. Your thinking and your feeling and your choosing are always interacting with one another, but that's the human heart. And they're not three different components of the human heart. This is just one heart that thinks and feels and chooses. And this is true for children as well. So if we want to try to get to the level of why is a grieving child making the choices that he or she is making, then one of the things we have to consider is what's happening in their heart. What were they feeling that was behind that choice? What were they thinking that caused that choice to happen, right? This is what keeps us from being mere like behaviorist or settling for something that is superficial. The heart is where all this comes from. And this is true of children just like it is true for adults. And at the same time, while we are people, we have these certain things that are outside of us. So you have God and circumstances and others. And unfortunately, it's off the diagram, but we also have self, right? So all of these components that are outside of us are perspective of God and circumstances and others that are influencing our hearts, okay? So circumstances are influencing what people think, feel, and choose, but they're outside of that person's heart. In a real sense, God is outside of somebody's heart, but he's influencing what we think, feel, and choose. Right, I understand like God is in our hearts through faith. What I'm talking about is we have a perspective of God. God has a perspective of us. And there are other people that are trying to influence a grieving child. And grieving children look at other people a certain way. Sometimes they look with trust and confidence. Sometimes they look with suspicion. Sometimes they look with accusation. But this is how the human experience works. So this is kind of the guts of chapter 3, the core concept of thinking, feeling, and choosing. It's the dynamic heart. Okay? All right. So children, I'm convinced, need loving caregivers to help them understand and process the effects of grief on their hearts. In other words, children are not just going to be able to experience a circumstance like grieving death and be able to think, feel, and choose clearly on their own. In other words, they don't have the capacity to just naturally think, feel, and choose all of the right things and even understand what's happening if there isn't somebody outside them, a loving caregiver that helps them work through what are you thinking and what are you feeling and what are you choosing. And when we fail to do that for children, when children, elementary age children, are grieving death and we fail to give them the kind of care that they need within their hearts, there are profound and I think even lifelong consequences. There are times when people will tell an elementary age child something that is not even true while they're grieving death, and at some point that truth ends up having to be faced down the road. It's similar to telling your children that a certain annual holiday where there's a large jolly person that, you know, shows up all across the world, and telling them that that is a reality. Eventually you're going to have to undo that story because you see that's just not true, and so eventually you have to take back what you told them. And there are times that and that's a kind of a silly illustration, but in grief it's much more significant. Anything we tell a child that's not true while they're grieving, we have to undo down the road. So there's things that children are told that aren't true, but even probably more common than that, just children are most often told nothing. Most often, grieving children are just left on your own, like, well, you're probably not having too hard of a time with this. You're going to figure it out on your own. You're just a kid. What can, you know, how bad can it be? And we just leave kids to their own devices. Like, yep, you figure it out. So what happens? Well, kids can try to fill in the blanks themselves, which means they may or may not be thinking what is true. They may not be processing their emotions very well. And they're trying to fill in the blanks because the adults in their lives, the caregivers in their lives, haven't helped them add 2 + 2. And so they just come up with their own answers sometimes. All right. So I think it's crucial for us in the circumstance of grief to help a child work through what they're thinking and feeling and choosing. All right. So we have to understand how the human heart works if we're going to help a grieving child through that. So one of the things that I say is kind of like a mantra way of understanding this is thinking hearts are believing hearts, feeling hearts are valuing hearts, and choosing hearts are committed hearts. So we're talking about what a child believes and values and is committed to. That's what's happening within their heart. And all those things happen because a child is made in God's image and then experiences within a physical body. They're reflecting the heart of God, who also thinks, feels, and chooses. And they're experiencing that within a physical body with its limitations of things like development. Okay? All right. What I want to do next is just show you. I'm going to jump out of my PowerPoint, and I just want to show you the table of contents to help you kind of see the direction of this. So pull it up for you here. All right, so where are we? We're getting closer to running out of time, but let me just kind of summarize where are we. All right, so introduction, I deal with the literature, where's the void, my actual thesis. I talk about this, a theology of grief, describing the biblical narratives and defining biblical terms, and then a theology of death, so the key biblical elements of sin is the source of death, and death is inevitable, and then death is overcome in eternal life. Probably only the middle one you'll get the middle one from some kind of secular source. You'll never get sin is the source of death and death overcome through any kind of secular literature. You'll never get told, why do we die, right? So from the secular viewpoint, you can be told, well, they died because of the car wreck, or they died because of the sickness. But kids never find out that sin is the source of death if there's not a biblical worldview, right? Death is inevitable, something we need to be able to communicate to our children, but also the hope of resurrection, that there is such a thing as eternal life, right? So a theology of death has to come from a biblical perspective. End of every chapter, I do a gospel connection, so that was something that was important to me to include. All right, chapter 3, the dynamic heart, just explaining it. Here's the thinking hearts, believing, valuing, and being committed. And then the context of God's self, others, and circumstances, and again, the gospel connection. All right, in chapter 4, go into the idea of development. So felt like it was important to establish the value and capability of children in this chapter. So children's value and capability is a uniquely Christian worldview. I touched briefly, I'm certainly not an expert in it, but touched briefly on even some original psychological views of children that taught that children don't have the capacity to grieve. So for instance, Freud actively taught that children can't grieve. They lack the components they need. So because of his whole teaching of ego and id and all of this, he taught that children can't grieve. So basically for a bunch of years, the psychological community said you don't have to worry about children grieving because they don't have the capacity to do it. That has thankfully shifted even within the psychological community to say like, no, actually there's evidence, there's empirical reasons for us to be able to go, yeah, no, children are definitely grieving at really young ages. But that thinking that children can't grieve is, I think, not just from early Freud days. I think a lot of people, a lot of even adults, end up thinking that children can't really grieve or can't grieve well because of failing to grasp the difference of a developing heart. So kids don't present some of the exact same behaviors and actions that adults do because they're kids. All right, so you'll have a kid and there'll be something that's sad, and maybe a parent will sit down with them and they'll be sad, and 8 minutes later they want to go play with the cat in the backyard, and parents go, oh good, they're fine because they just want to go play, right? But part of the reality, and something that really stood out to me kind of throughout this process of writing this, is children, I even use this expression in my thesis, children have a limited emotional attention span. So I think most adults are familiar with the idea of a mental attention span. If I said attention span, most of you would be immediately thinking about, yeah, children can't sit and listen to something as long as adults. They have a mental attention span. But I'm convinced that children also have a limited emotional attention span. In other words, they can't maintain a sensation of sadness, anger, you know, whatever. They can't maintain that over a long period of time, just like they can't maintain attention to a particular topic over a long period of time, which, think about it, makes sense. If our thinking is connected to our feeling, the fact that children have limited attention spans mentally necessitates they have limitations in their emotions, right? So a kid that wants to go play with a cat, it's not because they've dealt with their grief, it's because that's all their emotional attention span could handle, and guess what's gonna happen? And this is what some research has proved. Children actually grieve much longer than adults because it takes them longer to process, right? They're not able to give a sustained attention to their grief, and so for a child, grief comes in these waves that end up taking them much longer because the wave comes up and now it's down, and now they move on to some other emotion, like I want to go play. And they move to even things like happiness. And we go like, oh, the kid's happy, so they're fine. But that happiness is then replaced by sense of loneliness or some other sensation in grief. So I think the reality of children taking longer in grief is connected to this idea of an emotional attention span, which means that caregivers, parents, have to be ready in the moment and out of the moment, because the kid's going to feel what they're going to feel when they're ready to feel it. So for adults, we can manage our emotions a lot of times, right? We package our emotions, and so in one setting, we have steely resolve, and we're gonna be strong for the people around us, and then we just wait to like break down in tears when people aren't watching, right? Like, we have that capacity as adults. Now, I'm not suggesting that's a healthy way to deal with your sadness, right? But you can do that as an adult. You can bottle it up, I'm fine, right? And then it's only when you're in the right setting, maybe it's a certain amount of privacy or with a certain person you trust, but you don't express that emotion, because you're an adult and you figured out how to handle those emotions. And a lot of times children haven't figured that out yet. So when they're ready to feel sad, they feel sad. But when they're done with that feeling of sadness, they're gonna move on to the next feeling, but they're gonna come back again and again, right? So what I'm suggesting is this idea of an emotional attention span is something we should care about with children. All right, so there you go. It's the idea of the experience of grief in a developing heart that includes their minds that are developing and their emotions that are developing. All right, the last chapter, we just talked through some of the challenges for caregivers, what kind of systematic methodology can we come up with, and then biblical resources and communication strategies. So, on the note of resources, as my time was quickly going, I just want to share a few things that I appreciated. So I already showed you the Dynamic Heart and Daily Life. Fantastic book. Thankfully, there have been more resources lately, and so I brought these if you want to look at them even yourself or get some. So Paul Tauches, incredibly hard name to say, but somebody that has done some good work on grief. So this is his Comfort the Grieving, a great overall book on grief. This is his small book for the hurting heart, which is basically daily devotionals, meditations on the idea of loss and grief and healing. So you could use this as a, they're even listed in like, here's day one, day two, you know, day, so it's a devotional kind of approach to considering grief. This is Tim Challey's Seasons of Sorrow. I referenced this book during a Sunday school class, and where I jokingly said, I don't recommend this book. Like, this book, I cannot read more than two pages without literally crying. Like, it is the most, like, painful, honest. This book just tears me up. So I cried, like, I kid you not. I was in the library at the Master's Seminary. I'm downstairs in this very sterile environment during the 2 weeks, which, by the way, the 2 weeks that you all gave me, that the elders gave me to work on this, I never would have finished this thesis without those 2 weeks. Like, literally, like, this project doesn't happen without those 2 weeks. When I went into that 2 weeks, I had, my whole thesis was outlined, and I had one chapter written. And by the end of those 2 weeks, I had chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 written, and then I just needed to clean up chapter 5. I had some of chapter 2 done, but just minimal. So basically, that 2 weeks like saved my entire degree, so I'm very grateful. Anyway, I'm in the basement of the TMS library. I got this book. I didn't know anything about it. I just was grabbing all these books on grief, and I started reading it. And I cried for an hour and a half reading this stupid book by myself. I'm just in the basement, just bawling my eyes out as I'm reading page after page. So why would I commend this? Because Challey's, he's a pastor. His son, who was recently engaged, he had just finished college, he was starting seminary, actually at Southern Seminary, which is where I got my degree from. He just died. They were playing frisbee out in the yard, and he just collapsed and died. And Challey started writing this book literally on the plane ride. He's Canadian. As he was flying from Canada to Louisville, hadn't even made it to see his dead son yet, he started writing his thoughts down. And this is the first year of him journaling, the first year of his grief after his son died. Right, it's as honest as you've ever read, but it's also as biblical. This is an amazing book that'll tear you up if you have any heart whatsoever. So anyway, Seasons of Sorrow, but also very hope-giving, and so I do recommend it. It's just not at all an easy read. All right, Julie Lowe is a name I've come to appreciate in counseling and counseling children. So this is her Building Bridges. These are actually activities for children and teens. So it's got all these kind of like object lessons and illustrations and what are ways we try to connect. This is part of the creative communication strategies that I'm talking about. So really appreciate Julie Lowe. She also contributed a chapter that I reference a lot in my thesis. This is called Caring for the Souls of Children. It's from Amy Baker. It's a biblical counselor's manual that has a bunch of different writers in it, including Julie Lowe and others. They write on all kinds of topics. You can see that I use this a lot because the book is all like chewed up. They deal with specific counseling issues, so children relationships, children and emotions, children and their bodies, children and trauma. So this is a fantastic book on counseling children. All right, this is a book that didn't exist when I started my thesis, and this is the book that I wish I wrote. All right, so I wish that I had written this, but I'm glad that it was written by people that are better than me. And this is from Ed Welch. That's a great name in biblical counseling. It's called Good News for Little Hearts. That's the series that they've done, and this one is When You Are Sad. And it's called Henry Says Goodbye. There's a bunch of other ones within this series. The series is Good News for Little Hearts, but like this one is When You Are Angry. Jax's tail twitches, and I think you all should be able to like connect that to your own anger. Like, you know what it's talking about. When You Are Anxious, Zoe's Hiding Place. So these are specifically targeted that I think could be useful to a child who's grieving. So things like anxiety, that's a normal human experience during grief. Anger, that's a normal human experience during grief. But this one, Henry Says Goodbye, is specifically focused on when you are sad. And it tells a story about Henry the Hedgehog, whose pet ladybug dies. And this does such a great job humanizing the experience of sorrow. They basically... I'll just read you this page. I love kids' books. All right. The more Henry thought about how much he missed Lila, that's his ladybug, the less he wanted to go to school. He didn't want to talk to anyone. He wanted to curl up in a ball and hide. When Mama said she made his favorite blueberry buckle breakfast, he replied, "I'm not hungry." When she said, "You really should eat before school," he rushed toward the door, brushing past his sister and knocking over all of her blocks. He didn't notice that Haley was also sad. She loved Lila too. It just does this a fantastic job of like humanizing the experience of sadness. Talks about how he goes to school and he hides from all of his friends. He isolates. It just all of these things that kids experience in grief, and it just does it in such, I don't know, clever, clear terminology. His dad actually does essentially a funeral for Lila. That is a great example of like how a funeral works. And anyway, so I love this book. This was really well done. So those are some of my favorite resources that I found throughout this process. So, all right. Some key moments or some key takeaways when it comes to this thesis. I really think the idea of the dynamic heart is a necessary component of understanding grieving children. I don't think we'll understand development if we don't understand a child's heart that's thinking and feeling and choosing, and all those are developing. The idea of an emotional attention span, I'm particularly like attached or fond of that terminology. So I think it makes sense that children who have limits on the amount of time they can spend thinking about a specific topic will also have limits on how long they'll feel emotions about that topic, and we should understand that as adults. The idea that there's value and capability in children is an important part of this thesis, and then trying to work through some age-specific applications, which I didn't spend time this morning doing, but I think that's an important takeaway. So, I think if we can have a clear theology of death and grief, we can understand how a grieving child's developing heart works, then we can have some wise, practical, and creative communication strategies that really can lead to help for a child. As I come to the end of this whole process, I would say I did not start this process because I was an expert in grief and in children, and when I finish, I feel even more so that I'm not an expert. I didn't start going, I should do this because I know so much. And when I finished, I'm also going, I don't know so much. That grief is so, it's such a difficult experience. Every child is unique. Like, there is no like one size fits all solution for children. I'm hopeful that some of the work that I've done has already informed like my preaching and my counseling for the good of you all and others. If there's any way that my thesis can be helpful to even beyond just me, I would love that. But I think it matters that we realize that children need people that love them to help them through the experiences they go through in life. So I focus specifically on elementary age children and grief, but I think that the same thing is true. Children need people that love them to help them interpret, to help them understand what's happening in the world around them. And God gave them us. He gave parents and friends and Sunday school teachers and pastors, and he gave us to children to help them through, whether it's grief or anything else. Okay? If you are crazy, no. And what my thesis? No, just if you want my thesis. How can you get my thesis? You can just text or email or ask or show even the slightest sliver of interest. And since it's so fresh in my mind, I will eagerly be like, hey, do you want to read it? I'll give it to you. So I can send you a PDF. You might have seen in the table of contents, it is over 100 pages long. It's academic, so it's not like, oh yeah, I'm going to read this and it's going to be exciting. But I am happy to share my thesis with anybody who wants it. So all you have to do is ask, and I will happily give you a PDF that you can read at your leisure. And I won't even follow up and ask if you've read it. You can just read it or don't read it. But I'm happy to share it with you if you want to see it. Okay, Melanie.
I have a question.
Yes. Yeah, great question. So any tips on like starting a conversation? I don't have a great tip for you. I think what I'd encourage is it really matters that we relate well to the kids in our lives. And so kids are certainly not gonna initiate with somebody that they don't have a reason to trust, or there has to be something that's already there. So it's one of the reasons I think it's really hard for people that like counsel and work with children. I'm super grateful for them, because that's so hard when you don't have a personal reason to know them. We have such an advantage in the church, I guess is what I'm saying. We don't have this formal, like a kid doesn't even know you and the parents are like, I want you to sit down and talk with us. But that's so hard to do, like out of the blue. But if we can build relationships within our church family, within your friends, within the community, like the kind of kid that you go like, my heart hurts for this kid and I wish I could say something. If we've already built a connection with them, it's just such a platform for being able to connect with them. So maybe that's not really a tip as much as it is. If we can really lovingly connect with the kids in our lives, you never know when that is also gonna pay off down the road, where they're gonna see you as a person that they want to trust and connect to. But I think the second thing that maybe is a tip, maybe not, but is just, I think that as adults, we should be way more direct and blunt with kids than we are. So adults are usually the ones that go, well, I'm not sure the kid's ready to have this conversation, right? Or I'm not sure they want me to go there. And we just wait as if the kid's gonna and then initiate a really hard conversation. I've mentioned before Jessica's house, which is down in Turlock, and the time I spent with them was so like meaningful. But one of the things I appreciated so much of what they did, but one of the things is when the kids come in and they check in, the first question, they say hi to the kids, and the first question they ask is, what's the name of the person who died? And every night when kids come to Jessica's house, they know the first thing they're gonna be asked is, tell me the name of the person who died. They don't say, tell me the name of the person who passed away, tell me the name of the person who's gone. They tell me the name. I wanna hear you say out loud the person's name, and it's the name of the person who died. And it just sets the tone and the agenda of, this is what we're doing. We're gonna talk about a person, and you're grieving this person, and they died. And there's a bluntness to that a lot of times adults try to talk around that kind of stuff. And I'm not sure that actually helps kids the best. Like, I think we could be way more direct with kids than we often are. So I don't know if that helps or not, but I think we could be more direct, especially if there's been a relationship that's been built. There's a reason for them to trust you, so.
Okay,
yes,
I got like
please.
Two quick ones, but and I know you did this specifically on death, but in your opinion, do you think that this type of grief can show up in kids who maybe are facing divorce, or even like a friend moving away, loss of relationships in that way? And so that's one, but
yeah.
I'm gonna throw the other one out. Do you have any examples of things, you said that sometimes things that we tell kids that are not true will show up later. Like, are there
yep.
any like specific things that you saw that maybe are, that you, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So the first one is, you know, can this apply to things like a child who's grieving a divorce or a friend, you know, losing a friend? I would say maybe generically, it's just not very specific to that. So for instance, there's elements of maybe even a specific kind of betrayal that a kid might feel during divorce or friend leaving that maybe they don't feel the exact same way. Kids do sometimes feel betrayed while they're grieving death. But there are some particular struggles that a child might face that are more profound in a like divorce situation or a friend leaving. So there's a version of loneliness. So yes, loneliness is a part of grieving death. I just don't address it super specifically. So broadly speaking, yes, there probably are some general things that are just true because it's true of human experience. But I wouldn't say I targeted that very much. And I would hope for resources that do a lot more focused job on talking about that. There's another thing this thesis did for me is realize how generic I often am. Like when you try to really narrow in on one thing and go like, sometimes I stay very generic. I want to do a better job being specific with specific life experiences. So I'm probably less inclined to say this is useful to other things than I would have been at the beginning. I would have been like, yeah, you can apply it to whatever. Now I'm like, I don't know how much good it is for children grieving death, let alone I'm not sure how much good this is doing for someone that's grieving something different. So. That's the first thing. Second thing, some specific examples of like unhelpful things that happen. Some terminology is specifically unhelpful, whether it's done in a religious, like with a religious spin or not, but they went on a trip, right? It's really unhelpful to tell a kid that so-and-so went on a trip. Well, when are they coming back? Why did they choose to go on a trip when I wanted them to be here with me? Why did you say, there's like the religious spin on that is, well, Jesus wanted them to be with him more, you know, Jesus, they matter more to Jesus to be with him. And the kid goes, what, so Jesus doesn't care that he doesn't want him with me? And, because that's just not true. It's not that people die because Jesus wants them to be with him more. Jesus doesn't need a friend, like, he's fine. You know what I mean? And so kids go like, why, oh, Jesus doesn't actually care about me. And right now you have to undo this whole, like, Jesus just wanted a friend. And the kid goes, well, that was my best friend. And, you know, so those are just examples of the kinds of things that maybe are trying to soften the grief, but they're just not true. You know, yeah. Trying to dodge, even I mentioned kids being able to handle things that are blunt. There's times that people try to dodge the physical realities of death, and so they act like the body's just gone. You're like, no, that body is, and the kid's going like, well, wait, I went to a funeral and there was a casket and now it's in the ground. What do you mean the body's gone? Like, when you say things that aren't true, well, their body's not gone. It's not. That body's still somewhere. Well, we don't want to talk about that. And okay, but now you just told your kid something that's not true, right? So those are just a couple examples of things that I like read or saw. Anything that tells a kid the person that died made a choice to not be here is a, like, well, really? Like, that's what the person was choosing? Like, so that's a hard thing to tell a kid. Devin.
Speaking on being, like, very direct with children, and the part I'm going to bring up is even hard for adults, but is there anything you found, or even that you end up writing, where you have to speak on someone's salvation?
Yeah.
Even with our kids here, you mentioned hell last week.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, what? How would you approach that, knowing that someone was not a Christian?
Yeah.
Actually, was a whole different religion.
Yeah. One of my biggest surprises of something I found during this thesis was actually a sermon that J.C. Ryle did to kids, which I know I say J.C. Ryle a lot, but honest, I wasn't looking for J.C. Ryle stuff. I just happened to come across this sermon of his, and I'd really recommend it. So if you look up J.C. Ryle's sermon to kids, I can give it to you later too, but he does a great job, I think, mixing biblical reality with directness, and he addresses hell specifically to kids. What I would say is, we want to, there are times when we don't know if someone was a Christian or not, and we need to be able to say that out loud. Like, I don't know where they are right now, right? And that needs to be something that adults need to be able to tell themselves as well. I don't know. We don't always know somebody's heart, what did they believe, how much of what they lived lined up with what they actually believed, right? And so we go, well, I don't know. And I think we should always follow it up with, I don't know, but God would never do something that is wrong. God would never judge unjustly. God always does what is right. So we want to reinforce to our kids, wherever they are, God has done what is right. And so that thought also applies to, what if it's somebody that you know is an unbeliever? So as hard as this is, I think if we're actually going to believe the Bible, we need to be able to say, there is nobody in hell that has been mistreated by God. God has never failed to love somebody or care for them. The fact that they are in hell does not then violate the fact that God is a God of love and of salvation and of all the other things that we love about God, right? And we don't want our children to now think that death or somebody going to hell is something that is outside of God's control or is outside of God's character. So if we're communicating things to our children that someone going to hell is outside of God's control, we've told them the wrong thing. If somebody going to hell is a violation of God's character, we have a whole wrong way of thinking about God. And now you just taught your child that, which you're going to have to undo down the road, right? So however we do that tactfully, we have to say God is in control and God's character is unviolated. It's perfect. And if you can communicate those two things, that's a more important thing than where is Uncle so-and-so or where is Grandpa right now. Well, I want to tell you two things. God does all that he pleases, and everything God does is right. That I can tell you for sure. So focus on the character of God and the actions of God to your children. Okay? All right, I've gone over. Thanks for listening. I hope some of that's helpful. If you want the thesis, just let me know, and we'll see you in the worship service.